Well, we'll set the context for our study today like this. There are different stages and different circumstances of life that tend to prompt self-reflection. So for example, if you're maybe preparing to move somewhere far away, that tends to be a time in life when we reflect on things a little bit more than other times. Or if you're preparing to get married, or maybe you're about to have your first child, or maybe you're making a big job change, these are all seasons of life that prompt us to reflect on things about our lives. We kind of think about where things have been, the circumstances that have caused us to be where we are. We examine things maybe a little more closely than we normally would. And as we continue to move through the book of Ecclesiastes, we find that Kohelet, remember that's the Hebrew name for the teacher that we're introduced to here, Kohelet is at a stage in his own process that's brought him to a place of reflection. As we think about where he's been so far, we know that he's on this quest for significance in life. He started by speaking about the futility that he sees in life in general and the world around us. The wind just cycles round and round. And then he goes on to say our lives basically seem to do the same thing. One generation follows another. They're just a cyclical, to him, seemingly meaningless routine to all that is going on in his life and in the world. So futility of futility, he says everything is futile. It all appears to him to be wearisome. It's like mist. Remember, that's that Hebrew word there that's translated as futility. It's the word for mist or vapor that just evaporates into nothing. And so he takes it upon himself to try to search out some kind of richer and more full meaning in life. Where can significance be found? And so we saw as we got through the rest of chapter 1 that the first place he looked for that is in education. Back in chapter 1, verse 13, he told us how he set his heart, which speaks to the fact that he gave his whole self to examine and explore all that was under heaven. And he reminded us during that time that he's king over Jerusalem. So he not only has this desire to pursue knowledge, but he's also going to have the means to do it very thoroughly. He's in this royal position of power. So he pursues education. However, at the end of his study, when he's gained all this wisdom and knowledge, instead of grasping something of life's deeper significance, he actually just finds himself to be in a more sorrowful place. So there at the end of that quest, he says, with much wisdom is much sorrow. And then he says, as knowledge increases, he doesn't say life's meaning increase, he says grief increases. All right, so education and this accumulation of knowing all that can be known, that's not the answer to the sense of futility that exists for him in life. And so he continues his quest. In chapter 2, we have him opening with this pursuit of pleasure. He tells us how he then goes on to amass houses and vineyards and gardens and parks and fruit trees for himself and servants for himself and livestock for himself and silver and gold. He indulges in sexuality. And so Kohelet tells us that he's gathered for himself more of these pleasures than any of the kings who were in Jerusalem before him. He's accumulated all this stuff. So much so that at one point, we think that maybe he's discovered the completeness and the wholeness of life that he's been looking for. Because in chapter 2, verse 10, he does tell us that he's experienced pleasure in the pleasure seeking. So he does give us this quick word of something positive here. Maybe then indulging in a posture toward life that goes something like, the heart wants what the heart wants. You know, maybe that's the answer. Create for myself a life that's full of all the things myself wants. Remember how for myself is this repeated refrain through the section? Maybe that kind of pursuit and accumulation of stuff for myself is the answer. But again, we move past verse 10, and the final conclusion still isn't one of fulfillment. He did find some pleasure in pleasure-seeking, but ultimately, after pleasures have been amassed and even exhausted, Kohelet records that all this was still like trying to corral the wind. He still says there's nothing to be gained under the sun. It's all still just this mist. It's vapor, he says. Which brings us now to our section this morning. And in verses 12 to 26 of chapter 2, we find that there's a kind of pause now in this quest that Kohelet has been on. So he's done all the education. He's accumulated the material estate and all the pleasures that accompany this long list of acquisitions that he gives to us here. All of this has ultimately come up lacking. And so now here we find him pausing. He's slowing down, and he's starting to reflect. It's this occasion of reflection now in his life. And his reflection is one that takes the form of a kind of deeper internal turmoil. There's this internal wrestling that he's now engaged in. So we'll see in these verses how he reaches a point where he's looking back on what's taken place, and he's revisiting some former considerations, and as a result, he finds himself really in a pretty dark place. It doesn't end completely hopeless here, but there is some real darkness that Qohelet experiences in this season of reflection that he talks to us about. So just listen to the scholar Christopher Wright, how he describes what's taking place here. He says, what's going on in this internal processing of Qohelet is the battle between what is known and believed to be good and true and what is observed to be meaningless and baffling. Okay, so that's this tension that he's working out in his own personal reflection here. There's this battle between what is known to be good and true, and at the same time, there is all that's observed, which seems to be meaningless and baffling. And it's possible that we've known something of that particular battle in our own lives. You know, something of that kind of consternation that you just can't shake, where you know the right and true, but at the same time, it's very difficult to work out all this wrong that seems to be twisted up in it and around it. And that's where Qohelet is at. And he shares his own process of wrestling with us in order that we can actually take some comfort with the honesty of his own process, and we can learn from it. And not only that, but we can also see that while he's not necessarily embarking on a new quest in these verses, still in his own process of reflection here, there is an element of progress that starts to appear in a way that hasn't appeared before. And then we'll flesh that out. But it's just worth noting right from the beginning, just so we have some glimmers of light as we get into this, it's worth noting that if we were reading the Hebrew text of this passage, we would notice something unique that he's put in as a kind of literary device here. And that is that while this word habel, or that word for futility or meaninglessness, that vapor word, it's repeated four times in this section, there's also the Hebrew word tov, which is repeated four times, which is the Hebrew word for good. Okay, so you've got four meaninglessnesses, four vapors, and we've got four toves. We've got four goods. So it's as if he's maybe just turning the light off and on or something like that real quickly for us in order to show us that there is some goodness that's starting to come through and maybe balance out some of this futility that's going on. Which is helpful for us. As one professor once put it, it's not where you're at, it's the direction you're going. And as down as Qohelet's going to get here, he's going to get way down. Still, things are still moving in some tov, some good kind of direction here. And he's communicating that to us, even in the literary nature in which he puts us together for us. And again, that in and of itself is helpful for us because we live in a world where there is futility. I mean, creation has been subjected to it. Josh prayed about it in the prayer this morning. There is futility all around us. It's very real. We know the feelings and the effect of emptiness, of things not being as they should be, of places of meaning being devoid of meaning for whatever reason. They've just come up short. And it's possible that even this morning, as you're navigating your own life, you're uniquely aware of that sense of emptiness in life right now. There's just this sense of vapor all around us. But that vapor, that mist, it's not the only reality. There's also this good. There's this goodness that percolates amid all the distress that can be there too. And that's what Qohelet starts to discover as he reflects on things here today. So we'll work through the passage this morning. Again, we're trying to keep a good pace just to catch the flow of what he's doing here, which you know is hard for me, but we're going to work verses 12 to 26 out, Lord willing. That's the plan. And on the one hand, we could title this section. In fact, the thing I wrote at the top here is just reflecting on wisdom and work. But there's a sense in which that's a little bit too sanitary of a title that's for what's going on. You know, we might rather call it something like hatred of work, or we need some kind of despairing word worked in there. So we're not totally happy with that title, but we just see how he's got this kind of internal battle and turmoil that's going on. So maybe we'll just call it tumultuous reflections, okay? He's in tumult. He's up and down here as he goes. So verse 12, we'll start there, which kind of reads like a banner heading for this section. So in verse 12, it becomes apparent to us that he's taking this posture of reflection. In fact, I'll just read verse 12 again for us so we have it fresh in our mind. We have him say, "Then I turned," and we actually recognize that. He speaks that way pretty often when he's taking a new direction of consideration or whatever it is. "Then I turned to consider wisdom, madness, and folly. For what will the king's successor be like? He will do what has already been done." So as this begins here, we can just kind of imagine Qohelet standing in the middle of this vast estate that he's just finished building and he's indulged himself in enjoying. You know, all this stuff in chapter 2 before this. So he's got the gardens all around. He's got the vineyards. He's got the servants tending it all. He's got all this silver and gold and cattle, all of these things. And we can imagine him just sitting in the middle of all of that and determining that while all this is striking him as just extremely empty of true meaning, he decides that he's going to go back and revisit some things that he's already considered. So he goes back to reflect on categories that he's already been thinking about. If you think back to chapter 1, in verse 17, for example, he's already said that he applied his heart to understanding wisdom and madness and folly. So he's already done that. And we also know that he's thought about the cyclical nature of human generations already. And then here, he's thinking about wisdom and madness and folly again. And he's thinking about the king who comes after him, what he'll be like. And he concludes that the best that person is going to do is just whatever's been done before. So you've got this kind of cycle coming back around. And he's thinking through these things again, which all sounds a lot like chapter 1. Right, wisdom and madness and folly, and then he's back there. He's already been saying things. Can anyone say about anything? Look, this is new. You know, one generation goes, one generation comes. They're forgotten. Nobody's really doing anything new. And so here in chapter 2, he's revisiting this same kind of notion, right? Wisdom and madness and folly, and generations come and go, and there doesn't really seem to be anything new. So we can tell here that he's not really embarking on a new quest. He's not taking off in a new direction. He's done education. He's done pleasure. Now he's not taking off on a new quest per se, but he's thinking back. Right? He's reflecting. He's going over in his mind the material that he's already covered. So far, his quest just keeps yielding vapor. So he's going to go back to where he started out in this whole process, which is a method that makes sense to us. Right? If we can't find something, we look, and if we don't find it, what do? Well, we tend to go back and start again. If I lose my keys, I start with my jeans pocket, and then I scour the whole house for everything, and then what do you do when you're done with that? Well, I go back to my jeans pocket. Half the time it's there anyway, right? But that's the sense in which Qohelet engages in further reflection here. I'm searching for significance in life. I haven't found it, so let's actually go back and revisit some elements of this search, some things I've already been thinking about. Let's think back on wisdom and madness and folly, and let's think about this notion of nothing new and the fact that the generations just keep coming and going and coming and going. All right? So he's revisiting these areas now. And even just in this start to things in verse 12, we can actually find some significant help for our own seasons of deeper struggle. Because it can seem like we get to a place where it does all seem pointless. You know, I've tried to work these things out in my mind to no avail. I can't seem to connect the dots. There's still this elusive element that's present in my life, in my thinking, in my understanding of how I'm put together and how the world works. I'm struggling just to make sense of meaning. And in that, there can be a temptation to throw our hands in the air and just give up. You know, I guess I'll just never sort this out. I guess this is my life now. There's no real new direction that seems to be helpful. I feel like I've exhausted all the things I can try. And there's no doubt a sense in which that would be true for Qohelet here, because he's given his heart and his life to these really big elements in his quest for meaning. But we should notice that when he comes up short, He doesn't stop. In fact, he goes back to the beginning to walk some paths again. He goes back to the first places he looked for things, and he starts to trace out some elements of his search. And in that, there's something very practical we can learn. Because when the meaning seems gone, when the understanding appears to elude us, when the answers that we hope for don't appear, even after long periods and a lot of exercise in searching and trying to suss things out, instead of giving up, he teaches us to reflect further. Maybe we should say to reflect again, go back and walk some of those same paths. Maybe I missed something here, he's saying. So let's begin at the beginning and think through some of this again. So really a question that comes out of this for us is that of wondering if there's an element in your own life of faith this morning that you've given up considering. It just doesn't seem to make sense. It haunts you still, but there just doesn't seem to be a way through it. Well, what we do is we find good company with Qohelet, and we learn to go back. We learn not to give up, but we learn to revisit the processes, right? Which is very much verse 12, rethinking about wisdom and madness and folly, how generations come and there's nothing new. And what we'll see in this is there's actually going to be a bit of a downturn for him. He's not going to sugarcoat things. But in the end, there's also some real profit to be had. So far, profit like he hasn't even encountered yet. And so that's a helpful thing for us to be mindful of in our own lives of faith. We kind of have this heading statement. He's going back to reflect. And then, as we keep going, we can move into verses 13 to 16 now, where he does return to consider this notion of wisdom and madness and folly. That's where he's going to start, just like his headline told us. So he starts in on his reflection. Now it's good just to remind ourselves that the notion of wisdom in Ecclesiastes is a kind of general rightness and prudence exercised by a person as they navigate life. Wisdom in Ecclesiastes, at least for most of it, it isn't wisdom in the fullest sense of Proverbs, fear of the Lord kind of wisdom. It's down a little bit more on a humanistic level. Remember how we had the focus where Qohelet is saying, I all the way through, and where he's speaking about things for myself, for myself, for myself, all this language of under the sun, right? He's not getting vertical in his orientation. He's horizontal in the world around him. So it's not wisdom that's first oriented under God in a proverb sense of the word. This is more under the sun wisdom. And we actually saw that last week where Qohelet pursues the pull of wine, he says, with wisdom still intact. So here's King Qohelet exploring some things and including the pull of wine. But that's not Proverbs fear of the Lord wisdom. Proverbs fear of the Lord wisdom tells us in Proverbs 31 that it's not wise for a king to indulge in wine because then he might forget what he decreed and he might pervert justice. That's God's wisdom for kings. Qohelet's he's going underneath that line here. So he's engaging in ways that might not quite line up with God's wisdom, but still there is a kind of prudence that's being exercised. So that's what he's thinking about. It's a reflected posture of trying to navigate life in a way that accords with reasonable justice as I'm looking out at the world, reasonable prudence, trying to live in such a way that the world fits well together. That's his exercise of wisdom in Ecclesiastes. Madness and folly, on the other hand, reflect categories of, you know, immorality and foolishness, just as they would in Proverbs, right? Madness and folly reflect a kind of willingness to abandon prudence and ultimately act in ways that are personally and even socially destructive. That's where madness and folly gets us. So we have that in our minds as Qohelet starts this reflection on wisdom and folly. And he begins by making this argument for the advantage of wisdom. So verse 13, if you look at that, he speaks about how wisdom has the advantage over folly like light does over darkness. Right? And then he actually gives us a saying of his own that sounds very much like Proverbs-type wisdom. Right? He says, verse 14, the wise person has eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. That sounds an awful lot like Proverbs 2, where those who abandon wisdom's paths are those who walk in darkness. So we do think to ourselves that there is some genuine orientation, maybe reorientation here, in a positive direction toward Qohelet, even in a little bit of a different way than we've seen so far in his writing. He's making it plain that on the other side of all this stuff he's been searching out and all these things he's been working through, he's saying that knowing wisdom has more than searching out folly. So wisdom has this advantage. At the end of chapter 1, he's actually saying wisdom or folly, all that is just trying to corral the wind. That's nothing. Here, he's actually talking about an advantage now. Living life according to folly is like walking through your house in the middle of the night without the lights on. You're going to get hurt, right? But living your life according to wisdom, well, it's like having lights on. It gives you perception that's profitable for living. So that seems like progress, and we kind of like that. That's some relief for us. We say, thank you, Qohelet, for giving us something to attach our own thinking to. Not everything must be futile. Wisdom seems to bring a significant benefit, right? It's like flipping the lights on in your life versus going through life with the lights off, all right? So not all is futile. Wisdom is good. We think that until we finish verses 14 through 17. Because things immediately, after this positive advantage of wisdom, they take this really dark turn. And we remember from verse 12, Qohelet's not just reflecting on wisdom and folly, but also on the passing of one generation to another. So these things are all in his mind. And as he's thinking about this, he gets twisted up yet again as he considers what really seems to win in the end. And what wins in the end isn't wisdom. Instead, from Qohelet's under the sun perspective, what has the final word isn't wisdom or folly for that matter, it's death. Right. So verse 15, why be overly wise, he says. What happens to the fool will also happen to me. There's no lasting remembrance of the wise. Verse 16, how is it that the wise person dies just like the fool? Now Blaise Pascal, the 17th century French mathematician and Christian philosopher, He made this comment that as men have not been able to cure death, misery, or ignorance, they have taken to not thinking about them so as to become happy. The best way we know, Pascal is saying, to be happy apparently is to not think about death, misery, and ignorance. Qohelet didn't get that message, right? He's thinking about it. He's thinking about how as wise as a person may be or as foolish as a person may be, in the end, one out of one dies. There's no ultimate sidestepping or mortality, no matter the highest level of prudence or most degrading practices of folly we engage in. So all the effort to live a life of prudence, what's the point, he says. And so we're really back to that Christopher Wright quote from the beginning where Qohelet experiences this internal battle between what he knows to be good and true. I mean, he's not lying when he says that wisdom has an advantage. He's seeing what's good and true there. But at the same time, there's this struggle between what is good and true and what is observed to be so meaningless and baffling in the fact that the wise and the fool all face the same fate. They all die. And so now at this point, Qohelet slides down into quite a state of disconsolate discouragement. Right? This reflection is not bringing him up like he might have hoped. Wisdom has an advantage in this life, but this life ends for the fool and for the wise. So verse 17, therefore I hated life because the work that was done under the sun was distressing to me, for everything is futile and a pursuit of the wind. I hated life. Now, We just need to sometimes put in little asterisks or little footnotes along the way to remind ourselves of what's all going on in the mind of Qohelet as he's writing here. We do need to remember that Qohelet is giving us this under the sun perspective. In fact, that repeats enough times in this chapter. We don't want to lose sight of that. He's not an atheist, as we'll see shortly, but at the same time, he's not operating with maybe the psalmist theology, for example, that allows for a kind of hope that transcends death. At the moment, Qohelet is still stuck in this place of considering all that could ever matter from this under-the-sun perspective. And this is where that's left me, he says. Hating life because of the seeming vapor nature of what is accomplished in life, that's just distressing to me. Right? He hates life. As one writer put it, it's only worthy of tears. Now, it's worth noting, just again, the way this is presented to us here, Qohelet doesn't say that he hates his life. Right? He's not in the place of purely personal depressed despair. Maybe like Elijah, you know, who was so discouraged as a prophet, he asked the Lord to take his life at that one point. And then he just needed some food and a nap. Do you remember that situation with Elijah? But Kohelet's not there. He's not in a place of that kind of angered self-righteousness like Jonah at the end of the book of Jonah, where he can't believe that God is going to spare these wicked Ninevites, and so he just wants to die, that kind of angered self-centeredness there of Jonah. Kohelet's not like Job in Job 6, who'd suffered such loss. He just wishes that God would take his life and end my life, right? There's the personal despairing of my life, of one's life that can go on, but that's not where Kohelet is at when he says he hates life. He's not in a particular place of self-pity or physical suffering like others can be, or like Elijah or Jonah or Job had been. Kohelet's operating more at this kind of meta-philosophical level, right? He's got a lot of good things in his life right now. Remember, he's sitting out in his gardens. Right? Sun is shining, so to speak. But he's hating life in a more overarching kind of sense. So he's loathing, he's expressing intense dislike toward the way life in this world seems to exist. Philip Ryken put it this way. He says, it's not just his life that he hates, but life in general, the whole enterprise of human experience. And we get to this point, and it can be a bit jarring for us to hear this sort of language, especially as it's coming right out of our Bibles. Right, the futility of it all brings us to this place. I hated life. And in case we think that Kohelet has just kind of slipped up and overstated his concern, in the very next verse, he's going to expand on this hatred some more. So he's not recanting anything. And it can be unsettling for us to hear this kind of language, but here we are again, encouraged by the honesty of Kohelet. He's not an atheist, we know that, though he speaks of life from just under the sun, and then he speaks of I, and concentrates things on himself. There's stuff going on here. His heart needs some working out, but he is the king of Israel. He's over God's covenant community of people, and he still speaks like this, hating the enterprise of the human experience. And while it's disorienting, we have to recognize the actual place of usefulness that this does provide in our own journey of faith, especially when we need to apply certain kinds of medicine from Scripture at certain times in our life. A sense of disorientation in life, even a hatred of what it seems like life can be like, that is not the equivalent to an absence of faith. And this isn't just Kohelet. Let's listen to the psalmist, Psalm 77. Keep in mind, Psalm 77 is part of Israel's corporate worship hymnal. Like they sang this when they came together to worship. Psalm 77. The psalmist says, in the day of my trouble I seek the Lord, in the night my hand is stretched out without wearying. Okay, that's good. My soul refuses to be comforted. And then, when I remember God, I moan. When I meditate, my spirits faint. When I remember God, I moan. I mean, I've looked at a lot of church websites, and so far I have never found that in the mission statement. When I remember God, I moan. Right? But what we see here is darkness that's present in Kohelet's reflection here is not something that's absent from a life of faith. Right? There's something here that's actually and realistically very, very comforting to us as we think about the hatred of life within the framework of faith. Listen to one writer speak to the nature of what's going on here. He makes this comment. He says, God holds us together, even the vexed and harassed among us. The wise who believe this learn not to fear revealing what is true. Learn not to fear revealing what is true about their despair or hatred. God's character and covenant anchor their voice and make every feeling and thought, no matter how beautiful or foul, a matter of prayer for God to enter, of presence for God to keep, of paraphernalia for God to redeem. What a wonderful way to put that. Right, the stuff in my life that brings me down so low, the fact I can be in a place that feels very far from faith, even as I'm presenting all of this in the framework of recognizing God's existence and his purposes in my life, this actually isn't far from his reach, but it's paraphernalia for him to redeem. which is a wonderful comment. Qohelet's low here. Qohelet's disillusioned, and with that he is refreshingly honest. So when I reflect on wisdom and folly and how death comes to all of us in the same way, I find myself hating this whole experience of life. Now that doesn't mean that Qohelet's going to remain in this state. Next chapter, he'll actually tell us there's a time to hate things, and apparently he's exercising that prerogative here. But here he is now, and he's honest about it. And that's such an important lesson that he keeps teaching us, because as people in the covenant community of God's people, we are not, we should not, we will not ever be the kind of people who have to kind of put on the fake smile and pretend like we're making it when we're not really making it at all. Right? We're not a smile through the pain group. I was recently in a conversation with somebody, and you know, how are you doing? And I'm blessed. All I can say is I'm blessed. And I know for a fact they're going through some very difficult things in life right now. And none of you people. I'm not using anybody's. I wouldn't do that. But it was a very strange interaction, because you know that there's a whole lot of things that are quite difficult. But we don't want to talk about those things. Right, we don't want to acknowledge those things. Instead, we'll just say what's positive, say what sounds like the best of the Psalms, and we'll just move on. But we need to be honest about things. We're an honest about the pain group of people. Right? We're an honest about the distress group of people. Right? So Zach Eswine says, "The wise learn to manage life not by frantically trying to glue together the knocked over vase, but by gathering all of the shattered, jagged pieces and powdered dust from the floor and bringing them then to God." Qohelet's got a broken vase. Things are shattered for him. But he's dealing with it in this posture of honesty, and we can feel free to do the same. And we need to be prepared, not only to speak in honest ways about where we're at, but we need to be ready to listen to others in useful ways as they express their own distress. You know, in the midst of the process, in the midst of sorting through things, sometimes it just seems like, well, we need to provide an answer right away. We need to provide the next steps right away. But sometimes we just need to sit with one another in the hardship and be quiet and listen to lament. Right? That's the only thing Job's friends did right, is they sat and were quiet for a while with him. Right? So Qohelet, he not only helps us with permission for honesty, but he also prepares us to hear others speak in honest ways and recognize that this is not out of sorts. This is not something that needs an immediate answer. This is a process thing that we're here for with one another. So he starts then in reflecting on wisdom and folly. He speaks to wisdom and wisdom's advantage. We think it's going to go up a bit, but then in the end, to quote Tim Keller, it's all still like trying to plow water. All right, what's the point? I hated life. But rather than stop in this place of animosity toward life, as we might expect or might even be worried that he's going to do, he keeps going. Which we have to admire is perseverance. And he moves from speaking about wisdom now to speaking more directly about work again. After all, remember, he's just come off this life of extraordinary accomplishments. You know, all the learning, all the real estate building, all of these things. He knows about work and an attempt to find understanding and pleasure in that work. And from that place of experience, he draws this same somewhat hostile conclusion in verse 18, where he says that he hates all the work that he labored for under the sun. And he gives us two reasons why. Right, reason one is in the rest of verse 18 to 21, where he says, "Who knows what will become of my work when the next generation gets a hold of it?" You know, who knows if they're going to be a wise or fool? Who knows what's going to happen to it? And this causes him great despair, verse 20. In fact, it seems like a moral category. Verse 21, it seems wrong that I should labor like I have only so that somebody else can benefit from all my work. It seems like a moral category of struggle for him. So that's reason one why I hate the work I labored for, he says. Reason number two is in verses 22 to 23, and it's this: when I'm working, there's no relief. All that happens is that days are filled with grief and nights have no rest. Verse 23. That's what I'm getting out of this. There's that song, I think it must be from the 60s, but it's at the 5 o'clock world. And we're up every morning just to keep a job. I got to find my way through the hustling mob. And it's the sounds of the city pounding in my brain. Anybody know this song? In the last line? Well, another day goes down the drain. That's where he's at. No relief in work. Days are full of grief. And I'm even kept awake by it at night. This too is futile, he says. In fact, it's helpful just to even see how he emphasizes this. If you just look at verses 22 and 23, in the Hebrew text, the word heart appears in verse 22 and 23 twice. He says, you strive with your heart in your labor, verse 22, and then at night your heart does not lie down, verse 23. So it's a no rest for the weary situation. And even worse, there's no profit for those who are weary from the work. You know, if you're accomplishing something, if there was a profit margin we could look forward to, that might make it worth it. But he says it's all just sorrowful. Now, we can feel that way about work. Have you felt that way about work? I strive in my heart, so I give my whole self to the effort, only to have it yield grief. The people who benefit from my grief work are those who haven't even worked for it. They haven't even earned it. And instead of rest, my heart doesn't even seem able to lie down. It's quite the perspective. Well, it's looking back on all this learning and accumulating, and this is where he gets, I hate all my work that I labored for under the sun. Wisdom ends, like everything else, we all die. And as for work, someone else just benefits from all my toil, and I'm tired. But then, there's this surprising shift in verse 24 and on. Now we should say this. This is one of those sermons where I should have put my watch out to begin with. I didn't. We'll wrap it up. But I don't even know where we're at. But Qohelet is honest. And this I think, is one of the things that makes him so endearing as a character. He's a very honest character, but he is extremely far from dynamic. He's not charismatic at all. He would be a boring teacher. He's like the Ferris Bueller Day Off guy at the front of the class, right? Right? He's got this kind of solemn and generally reserved tone where he doesn't get excited, even when we read things that think, my goodness, this should get him excited. He's got this flat affect. You know, he's not like the psalmist who gets excited when he knows this is a turn for the better. Qohelet just remains flat. And we know people like that. You know, some people have huge expressive responses even at the smallest things. And then there are those people who have no expressive responses even at the biggest things. Right? And Qohelet is that guy. Right? If you're watching MotoGP this weekend, which, as a good Christian, huh? We're watching MotoGP. There's one rider on MotoGP named Ayagura, right? And Ayagura has just been doing really, really well. And you know how he looks when he comes back to his garage? Nothing. Just nothing. All the while, these other riders who are doing well, they're getting excited, they're talking to their team, or they're doing really badly and they're punching the tank of their bike. All this expression, Ayagura gets back, he's just flat affected. I thought that's got to be what Qohelet was like to watch. Right? But we can imagine this. And as we get into this next section, we might imagine that just a little bit of a smile creeps onto the edge of his lips. Maybe just a little bit, because there's this real significant shift in verse 24. Where he says something not just positive about work, but he actually says something that orients his posture according to God rather than according to all the I, or myself. Right? In verse 24, he says, there's nothing better for a person than to eat, drink, and enjoy his work. I have seen that even this is from God's hand, because who could eat and who can enjoy life apart from him? And then he goes on to say that those who walk according to God's ways are given wisdom and knowledge and even joy from God. But to the sinner, those who walk contrary to God, their work only ends in the advantage of the one who pleases God. So all of a sudden, God himself is the hinge on which joy and wisdom turn. There's quite the shift that takes place. So this is some good that comes out of reflecting on this wisdom and folly and work treadmill that Qohelet feels like he's been on. As one writer put it, the preacher's not giving in to despair, but is beginning to see the difference it makes to live with God instead of without him. You see, up to this point, Qohelet has been very concerned with his own discovery and my accomplishments and my work's life. Right, he's been all about himself, all the myselfs and my accomplishments and my works, but that led him to despair. And now there's this little flicker of realization as he continues puzzling through what he sees. It's not in thinking about work as I make it or who I leave it to that's going to be the point of meaning in all this. That just makes me hate it. But there is something to my life that begins to come through. Some meaning to life that begins to come through as I see the fruits of the labor as coming from God's hand, even in the simplest form. Eating and drinking and enjoying. This comes from God's hand. It's not so much about my accomplishments that I'm kind of brooding over. It's about God giving to be enjoyed for what it is. I see it as a blessing that he gives to those who are turned toward him. So we have this glimmer of hope there, this movement where Kohelet's not too excited. I mean, he's still flat affect, right? But we have this glimmer of movement from this horizontal, under-the-sun focus to a recognition that the true meaning actually might be sourced above myself. It comes from God's hand. There's goodness in life as I see it as a gift from God rather than a self-centered product of my own. My concern is not with days to come and generations to come. That's going to be God's doing. My place is recognizing the daily goodness that God infuses into my life. Now, in the end of this section, the last word in verse 26 is still about futility. So Kohelet's not entirely relieved yet. But he's starting to process things in the right direction. So Ian Proven sums things up when he says, with God the giver at the center of things and the striving self displaced, there's now the possibility not only of wisdom and knowledge, but also of joy. God the giver moves to the center, the striving self is displaced. And this only sets the stage for further hope, doesn't it? Even in the most routine of experienced benefits from wisdom and work, I recognize that behind it stands not me, the tired maker, but actually God, the gracious giver. That changes how I enjoy a meal, right? But that also changes how I look at all of my life. It's not me and what this means to me and what I've got or not got and what's all going to come of it in the end. The first point of real meaning so far in Ecclesiastes is reflected not in my accomplishments, but in God and what he gives. It's not the whole picture yet, but we're moving that way. So how do we find meaning in life? Where's the significance? Well, there's so much to consider, but one starting point is this: God grants good things to those who walk in his ways. I can rejoice in the routine daily blessings and benefits of things I work for, knowing that the ultimate source is not me making, but God giving. Which of course again puts us right at the center of who God is and the good news about his grace and purposes. Right? The hope that we have exists in this life and transcends far beyond the boundaries of life under the sun. That hope is not one of me making, but of God giving. All of a sudden we're right in the central truth of grace that's found all throughout the scriptures. That hope is not one of me making, but of God giving, centering obviously on God giving his own son who did not come, Jesus did not come, lamenting that others would benefit from his work after he died, but he actually came willing to do the work, willing to give himself up in order that those who would follow would in fact benefit from his labors. You see how Jesus is the counter to Kohelet's own self-centered motivations here. The hatred of life that Kohelet experiences is ultimately countered by the willing gift of life that Jesus offers at the expense of his own giving. So we're moving in that direction, this direction of hope. There's still plenty of gray days. You know, for those of us who enjoy the melancholy, we've got a lot of good episodes still to come. So you don't have to worry. But with Kohelet, the light is shining just a little bit brighter. And maybe for you, that's just the place you are this morning. You know, you don't get it all. You don't get it all. You don't see it all. So much still doesn't seem to make the sense you need it to make. And you feel that vacillation in your own heart between hating life and trying to make sense of these things. But the light is shining a little bit brighter. And in a case like that, we can take joy this morning. Because even that is indicative of God's hand. The fact that I can look at something and take joy in it reminds me that I'm ultimately not the creator of good in my immediate life. I'm not ultimately the creator of good in the reality of the eternality of life. God is the giver of good. And as I find my life sourced in him, things start to make a little shift. Maybe it's not as about me as I thought, and actually, maybe that's a really wonderful thing. So Kohelet helps us along these lines, and we're thankful for it. So let's pray together. Father, we do pray that we'd be encouraged by this truth. We're thankful for the honesty that we find in the scriptures. We're thankful that this is a realistic book that confronts us with truth we know to be so active in our own hearts. And we pray that through this we'd be helped to fix our gaze on your provision instead of our own personal seeking to make meaning in all of these things. Lord, you're the one who ultimately gives, and we rejoice to be able to receive grace from your hand climactically through Jesus. We rejoice in that. In his name, amen.